Hello and welcome to our last and final official episode of season 2 of Wines Your Neck In. It's been a huge amount of fun this year and we are so glad to be running this off with one of our, we should call him a friend of the show, JJ Van Velde, who generously sponsored a couple of episodes through season 1 with Van Velde and Smith, which we will get to. JJ, thank you for popping by. This is a rare occurrence for me here. We get to do this face to face, which is considerably nicer. So JJ, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you very much.
Can you actually believe that I've managed to pin you down for 1 hour of just me and you time? Because I know for a fact I do your head in most of the times whenever I get this opportunity. So
the best thing is there's no beers on the table, there's no glasses of wine, and that's normally where we spend most of our time one-on-one.
Yeah, no, I think it's class for me to get the opportunity to bring you in. You've obviously been so supportive of the podcast through its growth and its journey. Season 1 we got through, you sponsored a couple of the episodes. You actually even gave away a free pair of boots, which, trust me, I know for anyone listening to this, they cost an arm and a leg, but they are amazing quality. They're really, really good boots. And I'm looking forward to getting into your kind of journey into the business world. But I think, you know, we sit here off the back of our season being cut short. Everybody who listens to this as a Worcester Warriors fan will know that our game against Gloucester has been cut short. And we kind of find ourselves in this weird limbo now, aren't we?
Yeah, it's a bit strange. Like, in my mind, I've had, we've got one more week. You've got one more week to go and do your units. You've got one more week to experience X, Y, or Z. Mm. And then all of a sudden, again, it's just been taken away. But that's like most of this 12 months, or maybe longer, it's been so many things that we can't control that we've just got to adapt to. So it's just another week like those.
Yeah. If anything, would it be fair to say that this last 18 months in the world of professional sport, not just in the world of professional sport, but in anyone's life, you just had to develop this ability to adapt to any situation and scenario because it can change in the flick of an eye.
Yes, and like most of our fears are the uncertain, the unknown. Mm. Now all of a sudden we've been in this environment where there's been a lot of unknowns, uncertainties. But I think that brings out the best of most people. I think if you play rugby like me and you do or whatever environment you're in, a challenge is most of the time we relish any challenge. So it's actually been very enjoyable. It taught me a lot over the last 18 months. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah. So throughout this journey, you know, we're gonna touch on, I've known you 7 years now, someone I've got particularly close to through the club. And we have had so many great chats about your upbringing and your life, just like you mentioned, usually revolving around having a beer or a couple of rosés. But I think to set the
Do you remember the day we met?
I remember the first time we met outside Six Ways whenever you were doing a boxing class and yes. I just arrived late because I was on some Irish pubs tour.
Yes, and you were wearing green short chinos and a white t-shirt and you were walking with Carl Hogg. Yes. And I looked over to my right, I saw this bloke. I was like, all right, I wonder who this is. Started speaking. I was like, I don't care. I don't understand. I'll get to know him in 6 months' time.
In fairness, your English was dubious at best at that stage, but I think let's touch on the early days, because I know it's a huge factor for you as a person. You're like experiences growing up in South Africa, your attachment to Afis, and I know you listened to the episode with AB de Villiers with quite some interest, because you and AB, well, there's a backstory between you and AB.
Yes.
But before we get to the Afis, let's just talk about your upbringing. Like, growing up in South Africa as a child playing rugby barefoot, what are the memories that pop back into your head?
So yeah, I had a very fortunate, grew up in a very small town, Secunda. Both my parents still live there. My sister lives there with her husband and 3 kids. Typical South African small town village. You'd cycle to school. You'd spend most of your times on a bicycle between friends' houses. Every weekend you'd be at someone's house. Had really good friends as a young boy there. There was an alarm that went off every night at 6 o'clock for some reason. I don't know why, but at 6 o'clock, you could hear this alarm go off all around the town. And if I just made sure I was at home for 6 o'clock, I wasn't in any trouble.
How often were you late?
No, you're late once or twice, and then you learn there's consequences for every bad action. But yeah, I can't tell you how fortunate I was. Like, I lived outside permanently for 11 months of the year. I was allowed to play any sport I wanted. I went to a primary school, which is relatively small for us, which is only 1,000 kids in the primary school. Really good friends. Both my sisters went there as well. So for us, January, February, you do athletics. I did everything I could. I wasn't ever the fastest person around, but I loved shot put. Then we went into a rugby season, started playing rugby, full contact rugby from the age of seven. Really enjoyable. My dad did a bit of coaching, but like I've always had a coach that had a big impact on me, whether it was Meneer Breves, who was just a, he was a grade two, which is standard when you're about 8 years old, had a big impact on me, introduced me to my first headgear.
Which you ditched.
Yes, that didn't last very long. But then played cricket, try and be involved as much as I could. My sister's a very good tennis player. My mom was a really good swimmer. So I tried everything. I was always outside, always had a ball in my hand. So yeah, it was a great time. It was a great place to grow up as. And a lot of people around my age that ended up being very good friends for a long time in my life, which is brilliant.
It's amazing to hear. It gives me goose pimples thinking about it because I know desperately that long term you see yourself back there and raising your own family there, and that's probably as a reflection of your childhood experiences, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm, and we'll probably get into this more, like I'm very family orientated. I'm very close to my direct family. So for me, I want to spend a lot of time with family. So I made the decision to come over here in 2012. And that was one of the big things, which was, would I be able to cope? Would I be able to be with our family? And it's not been easy all the time, but it's been definitely worth it. So yeah, I definitely want to go back. My wife works here in the NHS. She absolutely loves it. We will have our challenges when it gets to that stage, but we're definitely in the UK for the remainder for another probably 5 years, I'd say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you built that beautiful big house where you live in for the next couple of years, and it'd be a shame if you didn't get to enjoy it. I think you touched on your experiences of growing up, and then I know that there's like a flashbulb, like a life moment for you whenever you get to go to AFIS, because AFIS is like an institution, and we've had so many cool people come on and discuss their experiences of going to AFIS and how it's molded and shaped them. And I know you're absolutely no different. Like when I go to South Africa, you have to take me around this place because I probably have it built up visually like different in my head, but I want to get a sense for how it feels for the people. I won't understand anybody. I only know a couple of Afrikaans words, none of which should be repeated. But I think if we talk about your experience at AFIS, like the person you are today, how much did that contribute to it?
It was a massive impact. I mean, I think it's the five best years of my life. I was never intending to go to AFIS. So about 100 kilometers from Secunda is a high school called Ermelo Hoërskool. It was my first choice. I really wanted to go there. There was a guy, JP Nell, who played for them. He was a fly-half. I met him when I was like maybe 10 years old once, saw him kick a rugby ball. I was like, oh, yeah, this guy is unbelievable. Just started televising rugby games, saw a game where he played. He went to Ermelo. I was like, I'm going to Ermelo no matter what. Cricket was always my first love up until I'd say 14, 15 years old. So they had a really good cricket team, good cricket coach. A guy I played representative cricket with was going to go to Ermelo. So Ermelo, I was set on Ermelo. Went to the open day, very nice, looked nice. There was girls in the school as well. So as a 13-year-old boy, you think brilliant. But my grandfather went to AFIS as well. My mother went to Afrikaans Meisie School, which is the girls opposite the road. So I said, I definitely want to go to the open day as well. So you got to remember, it's about 160 kilometers from ours. Yeah, it's further. You have to go boarding school. You're allowed to go home every weekend. You don't have to stay there for months. My older sister, Manika, she was now studying in Pretoria. So that makes sense because I'd have a sister nearby if anything went wrong. And then obviously my mother's brother lived in Pretoria as well. So there's always been friends who we knew.
Yeah.
And my first day went into AFIS, the open day, got my cousin was a year older than me, or is a year older than me. He went to AFIS as well. So he said, just let me know when you're here. And I got onto the school grounds with my mom and my dad. And I'll never, ever forget, if you go to AFIS, you'll see, you'll go through the main gates. You've got two big rugby pitches on your left, the main pitch on your right. And then you walk to this clubhouse and where they greeted everybody. And I opened the doors, greeted, and I just looked at the jerseys on the wall. I looked at the pictures of people, and I saw these guys standing there with their white shirts, grey trousers, green jackets, and they looked like men.
Yeah.
I looked at my dad, I looked at them, and I was like, whoa, they're like similar size.
Mm.
And I thought, brilliant. Walked to the boarding school. And I was just like, I'm coming here. My mom's like, are you sure? I was like, I'm definitely coming here. I don't care what it takes. I'm definitely coming here. So I made my mind up on the very first day. I walked onto Uffies. Best time of my life. Would never, ever regret going there. And I'd recommend it to anybody to go to boarding school at a young age, because you get thrown in the deep end and you learn to swim.
Well, you have to, don't you? I think you've touched previously on the guys who you share that experience with, guys like Vinand and AB. Like, what is it about Afis that it produces these hyper-successful people?
I think it's extremely competitive.
Yeah.
Like, it's 1,000 boys in one school.
Everybody
wants to be the best in what they do. Mm. We were, 250 boys in the boarding school. We sleep together. We eat together. We're constantly with each other. So it's the best time of your life, because you wake up in the morning and your friend's next to you.
Mm.
You go to breakfast together, you come back, you go to school. There was always a big divide between the dailies and the boarding school boys. So we'd always stick together. Because remember, we never had any packed lunches, because you're in the boarding school. If you don't make your own, you don't have any.
Oh, wow.
So then you've got the dailies there. They've all got these nice sandwiches and they've got a treat bar or an ice cream or a Coke, and you've got nothing. So there's always this divide. And I think, like, we were 10 friends. They were extremely close. We're still close to today. Like, yeah, we speak to each other weekly on a WhatsApp group. We tend together. They're going on a hunting trip next weekend together. So, like, it's lifelong bonds you make with these people. And the best thing about it is that they're not all rugby players. They're not all the superstars. Like, they are average people, but you just, because you share so many memories together, you've got all these stories to share with each other when you're much older. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, I've met some of them via FaceTimes and stuff whenever we've been having a few beers, and they seem like absolute top fellas. I think the experience of Afis allows you to develop and hone this skill, which at the time is rugby, but it also allows you to develop other traits and other qualities like teamwork, leadership and stuff. And clearly from a young age, you had those abilities and developed them, and you were allowed to go and express them. When you leave Afis, when the time comes for you to leave the school, is your mindset on pro rugby? Are you thinking, I'm going to be a professional rugby player? Or was there a sequence of events that kind of that made you fall into it?
So obviously sport, first love, always wanted to play sport. Then got to Afis, cricket, first love, all I want to do is play cricket for South Africa. I've got Jacques Cullis, Sean Pollock, Hansie Kroonier, all my heroes. And all I want to do is watch cricket, play cricket. Like, yeah, I would wake up at 3 a.m. to watch a test series in Australia. That's how much I loved it.
So
I
would you say it's still number one? Like, would you say?
No, it's not anymore. But at that time, like, I was very fortunate. I had a cricket net at home, so I would do throwdowns. My sister would do throwdowns with me. I would just spend as much time as I could in a cricket net.
Wow.
Luckily enough, I went to a few games at Supersport Park, which I watched AB de Villiers play, and he was a matric of mine at Uffies as well. So, like, there was always these boyhood heroes who were close enough. It almost feel like you can touch them. So you can almost it's possible to do this.
So what does it mean for AB to be a matric, for the people in the UK who don't know what that
so
means?
So in South Africa, you finish primary school at the age of 13 and then you go to high school at 14 up until the age of 18. So when I was 14 years old entering Uffies, he was in his final year. So he's a matric. So he would be the guy. You'd carry his bag. You'd make him a sandwich. You'd run and collect something for him. I don't know if it's still acceptable today, the way they treated us, but it molded me so much, because I was so fearful of them. I had such huge respect for them. And like, when you're playing for the under 14 A team, and you've got to remember this, probably 7 to 9 teams per age group. If you're playing for the under 14 A's, you're allowed to be a water carrier for the first team.
Wow.
So do you imagine me as a 14-year-old boy running on with water for a guy like AB de Villiers, Derek Keane, and I'm hearing them behind the post. So you're playing, there's 6,000-7,000 people at a match. Uffies is supposed to win. They've just conceded before halftime. I'm running on with water and I'm looking up and I'm standing, I'm thinking, I'm on the pitch. There's 6,000 people. I'm not even playing, but I can hear these guys speak. I can, and like, for me, those are pictures you can never take away from me, because I was just like, I'll never forget this guy called Cliff Milton, who ended up playing for the Bulls, Stade Francais, and then weirdly decided to retire and join the military. And I could hear him speak after they conceded, and he just like the simple words of, this is simply not good enough because we are better and I won't allow this. Like simple statements like that, I just think, wow, if Cliff is saying that, what is he thinking of me when I'm running on with the water? I need to be better or I need to be quicker.
You're on with 100%.
And you know, I'm not even quick. So there's so many instances. Like when I joined Uffies from a small town, my parents sat me down like before we had rugby trials. And they said to me, GJ, you got to remember, you're in a big pond now. You used to be a big fish in a small pond. So don't be disappointed if you don't make the under 14 A's. Mm. And I sat back and I was like, what do they think of me? Like, if they don't think I'm good enough to play under 14A, I will show them. And that's always been my driving force. So was supposed to play cricket, do a bit of athletics. First day of athletics, got invited to do javelin. Never done javelin. Secunda's too small to have javelin. I broke the record for javelin. Mm. The javelin coach was a first team rugby coach. And he said to me, GJ, if you want to play for the first team, you've got to be able to gym. If you do javelin, I'll allow you to gym. So within an instance, I've just gone, all right, it has to be javelin and cricket and rugby then because cricket won't allow me to put on size because I was never the biggest player. So then rugby just took off from there.
Yeah. And your experiences through into the Blue Bulls, like as a – we had Francois Hogard talking, you know, last episode about the experiences of running out at Loftus and what it meant to him. For you, the experience of playing for the Blue Bulls, the pride and the expectation also kind of muddled together. How do you reflect on those periods of your life where you break into the Blue Bulls team, play at a really young age, have – you know, life-changing moments playing professionally now for probably at the time the biggest, you know, John Smith wouldn't want me to say it, but it's the biggest club in South Africa.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, when you reflect on those times, you obviously at a very young age were willing to sacrifice and work harder than most people. You know, do you think back and have a huge sense of pride?
Oh, massive. Because, so you got to remember, I'm a Bulls fan. My dad took me to the 1998 Curry Cup final, which Franco Smit, who's now at Italy, was the starting fly-off, won the game. So I was a huge fan. Then got lucky enough in my final year at school, got invited to go and play in the under-19 Curry Cup. So in South Africa, the under-19s, the under-21s, and the senior team play on the same day.
Yeah.
So you imagine if we would have played Gloucester this weekend, there would have been three teams playing against three of them. So you'd play at 12 o'clock, under-21s at 3, senior team at 5. Yeah. So as a schoolboy, I already got exposed to a professional setup. Mm-hmm. Schoolwork became probably not my biggest priority, which is one of my mom's biggest regrets. So in your final year at school, you write two exams, which is your record and your final matric exam. So your record just tees you up for the final. I failed English in my record exam because I just didn't want to speak English. I didn't think I needed it, and I was stubborn. So my parents sat me down and said, if you fail English, your matric exam, you won't be allowed to continue playing for the under-19 Curry Cup.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, here we go. So I eventually sat down. I studied as hard as I could because in my parents' book, I always was going to go to university, get a degree, and live a normal life. Mm. Professional sport was always something to dream about, but none of us are fortunate enough to do it. Again, wanted to prove them wrong. So I studied really hard. I got really good marks to finish school, ended up playing under-19, and we won the under-19 Curry Cup. So straight off the bat, I got exposed to this winning culture. Really good coaches, which was a guy called Paul Anthony, who coached John Smith, Chili Boy, myself, a guy called Nico Serfontein, who played a bit of rugby league in England. He's now down at South Africa, SA Rugby Development. So really good coaches. The Bulls structure was made for performance and excellence. Everybody ran the same nine patterns, and I can tell you till today what those nine patterns are. So if you got picked up, let's say somebody gets injured on a Wednesday in the under-21s and you're good enough as a 19-year-old, you just slot in because we run the same play.
Yeah.
Don't care who we play against, we run the same nine plays, the same exits. And if you were lucky enough to have been invited to train with the senior team on a Monday, you would want to make sure you don't make any mistakes because it's all the same. There's no excuses to make a mistake. Mm. Now we just got to think about catching, passing, and ultimately play rugby. So lucky enough to get thrown into this professional environment where all I wanted to do is play rugby, play in front of these big stands, these big crowds, Because as a kid, that's what I grew up with. I wanted to be a ball boy like Johan van Graan was. Like that's, I wanted to be so close to the sport because I loved it. I loved every minute of it.
I just think it's there's something about the way that it was put together. Like even it's set for success to some degree, isn't it? Because it's very clearly culturally driven, and there's an expectation on how everybody's expected to behave. When you reflect on the time there, is it like you left in 2012? I mean, in a fantasy land, you stay there and you have X amount of caps and you go on to be a Springbok. Why did the move to Saints happen?
So against the odds, I got named the under SA19 captain to tour Belfast.
Yeah.
Just before that tour, I remember Heineken Meyer called me into the office, and you've got to remember this is the Heineken Meyer. You looked up at him. You didn't want to look him in the eye. You're so scared. And he said to me, GJ, I've got some tough news. I don't think you're ever going to be a professional rugby player. You're not quick enough. You're not strong enough. And ultimately, I don't think you're tough enough.
Mm. Wow.
And I left his office that day thinking like, I've just been picked as the under 19 captain of the Springboks. I'm going to Belfast I've been told I'm not good enough. I've got 2 years in a contract or whatever it was. And like that to me was one of the best meetings I ever had in my life, because I've just walked out there and I'm thinking, what a challenge. Like if I can prove him wrong, just imagine what he's going to think of me. Went to the under 19 World Cup. We had a great time, lost in the final to the All Blacks. But I also got nominated at IRB Player of the Year. And I got back off that tournament. I think I'm so happy. I'm glad I did what I did. I got picked up. I got picked to go and play in an invitational senior side. So I made my senior debut 2 weeks after the final. I think, chuffed, here we go. My next meeting with him was exactly the same thing. He just said, it's a fluke. Like, you played against boys. Like, wait till you play against men. It's a different ball game. And he's not wrong. It is a different ball game. But I have always, from the day my parents told me, don't be concerned if you don't make it, because this is a big challenge. Heineken Meyer, like that has been my fire for as long as I can remember, is prove people wrong. I love it when people tell me something's not possible, because I want to prove people wrong. And I am stubborn. And like my wife will tell this to you as well. I'm extremely stubborn. But I think that has made me.
It's a strength as well.
Yeah, I reckon it's made me who I was. I was fortunate enough to captain a lot of the teams I played in, which I really enjoyed. I never thought of myself as wanting to be a captain. But as soon as I got announced as a captain, I loved it. Mm. I've always loved it. I like speaking to people. I like the emotion side of rugby. Because I was never the fastest, I'm never the strongest, I don't have any X factor. I've always had to make up those shortcomings with emotion to perform at the highest level. But my move from the Bulls over to Northampton was, I had a really good season in 2010, played a lot of rugby for the senior side. We had a new coach. Like I was in a comfortable position. I was in a leadership position, but I wasn't the leader. I was young and up and coming. People saw me as the next thing. I just got too comfortable. It was easy. It was easy to walk into a restaurant and get a free beer. It was easy to, after a night out, to phone a club. You get in, you get free alcohol. My friends were all around me. They were all at university living their best lives as students. I wanted that, but I didn't want it. I still wanted to have the late nights, but I still want to be the bloke that's first in the gym, last out. And ultimately, a few bad injuries, a few broken thumbs. I just realized like I'm going downhill. Yeah. Like at the age of 24, I'm downhill. I've got these amazing Euros playing at the club, Dani Rousseau, Pierre Spies, Victor Matfield, Furida Preah, all these players, Wynand Olivier. And I'm training with them, but I'm not making the impact I think I am. And I met Christian Apt, who's still my agent today in Johannesburg. Had a meeting with him, and he said to me, I think there's a great opportunity for you to go to England. And I sat there thinking, who does he think I like? I don't speak English. I don't like the cold. Why would I want to go to England? And a very good friend of mine, Johan van Graan, like we sat at his house, and like he's a mentor to me, and we spoke about it. And he said to me, GJ, I think you'll regret if you don't do it. Mm. So he's ultimately the reason that persuaded me to come across.
Yeah.
It wasn't a decision that was made in a week. me and my dad, we actually flew over to England. We met all the coaches in Northampton. I met Nick Johnson because I wasn't sure. I wanted to come across here and experience it for myself to see whether I can make it or not. Because I thought I've got enough of a gut feeling to know whether I'd do it or not. Mm. Got to Northampton and I just think, wow, what a challenge. Like,
So what was it like when you rocked up and you're meeting these people? The culture's completely different. The banter's completely different. The Afrikaners are renowned for being quite direct, quite straight, but there's no like jokey jibey banter. You come to England and your English is at best broken, and you know you're thinking this is a challenge. The environment is probably quite good, and Saints were a successful team at that time, but. Reservations, fear, or just a desire to make it work?
I think it's a combination of a few things. There's definitely fear involved because it's unknown. I didn't know much of Saints, to be brutally honest with you. I knew Courtney Laws. I knew because I played against him at age group. Mm. I followed – at that time, you could watch a little bit of the Premiership on Sundays, but you follow a little bit of it. I knew Brian Majority. The year before I joined, they had a really successful year where they played Leinster in the final, sadly lost in Dylan's concussion scenario. So I knew of them, but I didn't know enough. In 2007, I got offered to go to Saracens, Eddie Jones. It was a 6 or 7. Yeah, 2007. Eddie Jones sent me a text message saying, if you ever want to join Saracens, let me know. And I thought, my friends, it's a prank. Like, I never, ever replied to this message because I thought it was a prank. And then when the opportunity came to go to Saints, it almost think like, maybe this is another prank.
Yeah.
Like, surely it's not for me. But once I got there, I met the interesting character, Nick Johnson. And I don't know why. I didn't feel like I was welcome in that first time. I didn't feel like I needed to be there. But a certain part of me felt like, this is one of the most difficult things you're ever going to do. Why not have a crack at it?
Yeah,
and gladly I said yes. Gladly I came over for 2 years, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was tough. It was really tough, but I really enjoyed it.
So, what were the main things that you missed? Family being an obvious one. Family and what else? Was it the temperature of the cold? Was it the early evenings where it was dark by 4 o'clock?
It's a combination of stuff. Family was a big reason because I've always been close to my family. Me and Mananta was dating. We've been dating for quite a long time, which meant we were going to do long distance. She was in South Africa finishing her medical degree, and I was now here playing rugby. It's first time I'm doing topless mauling in the snow.
Yeah.
It's cold. It's unpleasant. I can't express myself in a conversation.
Because of the language barrier?
Yes, I get when you don't speak a language that well, you concentrate so hard to follow the conversation. If we sit in a Starbucks and drink coffee, like I've got to sit there and look at your lips the whole time to follow, and I'm not even talking, I'm not even part of the conversation. I just want to know what's happening. Yeah. That was frustrating. It was like the rugby I found tough. I found it very physical. I found it slow, but I found it very physical. Like there was stuff like that, which you're just not used to, which I found really tough. But I think that's taught me a lot about myself. It taught me I'm way more resilient than what I think I was.
100%.
And it also helped that it was a successful club I was at. They were winning every weekend. I'll never forget, we were in around Christmas time. We might have lost maybe 2 games on the bounce. And the fans were like, this is the worst season ever. And I sat in a press conference and one of the journalists were like, what's your opinion on the worst season ever? And I was like, it's Christmas. So the season finishes in May and we've lost 2 games. But the fact that the people were expecting so much, I enjoyed that part of it. They never, ever wanted to be second. But it was a very enjoyable time for me.
I think you'd kill me if I didn't mention the some of the success times you had with Northampton, particularly when you went over to Ulster and ran over our good friend Ian Henderson to score in the corner of Ravenhill, as it was then. Like, the culture at Northampton then, it seemed to shift towards a period where they had less successful periods, and culturally it seemed to become maybe not as strong as a result of, I don't know, maybe just losing a couple more games than they're used to. But you reached the point at the end of that where you heading towards signing for the Worcester Warriors with Dean Ryan. Now, Dean Ryan I would love to know what his vision was when he approached you, whenever you started to discuss the initial, you know, 5-year plan, inverted commas, with Dean Ryan, because it would have been very easy for you just to stay around Northampton in this culture that's brilliant. Instead, you looked at this challenge of Worcester Warriors, the, you know, perennial bottom three side in the Premiership, maybe even in the Championship just before. What about Dean Ryan sitting with you? Where was it? And what did he say that made you think, this challenge is something I have to accept?
So at the Bulls, everything was about the family. Everything about it was about you, Niall, as a person, and Claire, your missus, because if they were happy and you were happy, you'd play better. So I came from this environment where players would spend 6-7 hours after a game in the training room together. Yeah. Like the best time of your life was a tour. And we always believed, like, if we can be successful, if that part of our life can be successful, we as a rugby club, results will always look after itself.
Yeah.
I went to Northampton and it wasn't the same. Dylan Hartley, unbelievable leader. He got men together and you managed to achieve great things as a group together. But it wasn't based on how important family is and how important your support structure was. And I struggled with that.
So what was it based on?
It's difficult to say. I can't put, they had extremely good players. You had Sammy Manoa, you had Khan, you had Courtney Law, Stephen Myler.
Yeah, world-class players.
World-class players, really good competitive squad. Like, yeah. Trainings were as competitive as they can be. And I think they just hit a balance where squad was at the correct age. Mm. But you also got to remember there was some broken hearts the year before when we lost in the final to Leicester.
Yeah.
So there was fuel. A lot of the second year's success was fueled by that year we lost.
Which it normally is, though. Successful teams normally have, even the Saracens and, you know, the Clermonts, they have success off the back of failure.
Yeah. And it was player-driven. Everything on the pitch was player-driven. Like, for argument's sake, we didn't really have a defence coach as we have now. You had coaches that stepped in and did a little bit, but everything was player-driven.
Yeah.
And I've got to give credit to a guy like James Wilson. James Wilson, who's now in New Zealand, played a little bit at Bath and Japan. He's probably the bloke that sat me down and opened my mind a little bit about how this is now player-driven. Coming from a structure where the Bulls, everything, whatever the coach says, you says, yes, I'll do it. How many times? I'll do it. I don't care. Yeah. Will I be successful? I'll do it. Coming to Saints, where it's not the same. It's not about 9 patterns. It's about playing rugby, having really good individuals there. So I missed that bit where the support structure and the family. And then Dean Ryan approached me, and I was going to go back to South Africa, maybe sign a contract there, but I wanted to be with my family. I wanted to be with Mananta. So Dean Ryan approached me the very first time. And I said to him, I'm really grateful for the opportunity, and I'm really grateful that you came to meet me, but I'm going to be honest with you, I don't think it's for me. I think I've got to go back to South Africa, and that's where I feel comfortable. And Christian, my agent, again said, I think you and Dean will get along really well. And I said to him, why? Like, I can't see it. Like, he doesn't speak a lot. I don't speak. I can't see it. And he said to me, GJ, please just meet him one more time. I think you'll really get along with him. Mm. I met him again. And things I spoke to Johan about, Johan van Graan, was like, how cool would it be to go to a place that's never had success and then bring success? How cool could it be when you are in a place and you can put things together the way you want it to be, because obviously you think you know what it takes. And the second meeting was at a services somewhere with Dean. Very unimpressive. The place was ridiculous, terrible coffee. But as soon as you started speaking the second time round, I was like, oh, that excites me.
Yeah.
Like, I sat forward on the couch. The more he spoke, I then wanted to chip in. I wanted to say my bit. And then I drove back that night and I was like, I think this could work. I think this is a man I can work with. I like what he's about. He's very straight down the middle. He'll say it to me as straight as it needs to be. And I like that side of people. I like it when people confront me. It's not that I like confrontation, but I like it if people have got the ability to confront me.
Yeah.
And he obviously got more than the ability. So I think just on that second meeting, I thought, oh, this could be it. But the family thing was always in the background. And the thing he understood very quickly, which I'll give him a lot of credit for, is he understood how important that to me is. I wanted to get married. I want to get married in South Africa. It was never going to be a winter wedding. So I said to him, Dean, I love what you're doing, but I want to get married in South Africa, and that's normally around January, February. I also want to go on a honeymoon. I've been away from Ananta for 3 years. We've done a long distance thing for a long time now. I think it's important that I've got to do this as well. And there wasn't even a second. He just said, yeah, it's fine, do it. And I thought to myself, brilliant.
Get it.
This bloke understands me. If he's willing to do that for me, I've got to do a lot more for him.
Mm.
Because I now have got to prove to him whatever he's given me, I'm worth every penny. So that was he was the main driver behind it. My dad didn't understand it. I've just gone from winning the premiership to joining the club that's been relegated. There's a lot of people, like a lot of my friends who's rugby fans, but not they don't really they just big supporters. They didn't understand it.
No.
I remember there was an article in South Africa saying, like, how do you ruin your career? You go from the Bulls to Saints to Worcester. Like, it's only downhill from there. But it got me to a place that I really wanted to make a difference. And that's all I've always wanted to do at Worcester. I wanted to leave the place in a better condition than what I ever received it.
Mm.
And Dean's 5-year plan sounded impressive. He's a man that can persuade you by dreaming. And I'm a dreamer. I like to dream. And then I like for someone in a meeting to go, that's not possible. And then I'm like, here we go. The fire's
lit.
The fire's lit. I've still got the dream in my back. And when I'm going to bed, I'm thinking of the dream. And I know there's people I can prove wrong, and that gets me going.
Yeah, it's such a great place for us to start, because that Champy year was one hell of a year, wasn't it? And I suppose the question for me is, as someone who joined in that Champy year, your first year, when you've agreed to sign and Dean's decided the contracts are done, you're joining the Worcester Warriors, what sort of vision did Dean impose for you as GJ? Like, what was the direction that he wanted you to take within the squad? Obviously, there was a leadership role where you ended up becoming club captain and working closely with a really good leadership group of like JT, Jonathan Thomas, who's now our head coach at Worcester, and Grovesy and Pennell and all these kind of older guys. You know, did he give you the reins the way you hoped?
I never even thought about being captain. Like, there was never a discussion. I turned up to Warriors and I remember this till today. I sat in the car park, first day ever, sat in the car park, and I said to myself, if I am going to do this, I'm going to do it my way.
Mm.
I will speak up when I think something's wrong, and I will follow my gut. I haven't got the track record to say that you should be captain of a team where you can't even speak English. I just said, I will do it the way I think it's right.
Mm.
And I might upset the apple cart a little bit. People might get offended if I say stuff, but I will do it my way. If I'm going to go at this at Warriors, I will do it the way I think's right, but still be open-minded enough to be pushed, because I don't know everything. I'm a young, whatever, 26-year-old. So I got there, I turned up, and sometimes things just feel natural. It feels natural to speak. We were a good bunch of friends. We were young players. There weren't many wives or children. I think Pennell might have been.
Pennell,
JT was probably the only guys who had kids at the time.
At that stage, yeah.
So what did we do? We spent an awful lot of time together away from the rugby club, which was brilliant.
It's a polite way of putting it.
Yeah, we connected, which is a word we use a lot today, but we built proper friendships.
Yes.
We were a tight-knit group. And like for us, it was always, oh, where are we going tonight? Are we having dinner somewhere? Are we going to the driving range? We spent so much time together off the field that when it came to the training pitch, it just went along. We knew each other better. I know what to say to you to give you a bit of a rocket.
Yeah.
And you probably can do that within a heartbeat with me, because we know each other that well.
Yeah.
So Dean's vision for the club was always going to be, it's a 5-year plan, where it's got to be about people that want to be there, people who want to be successful, and people who are competitive. That's why he signed us. That's why he got people in like me and you and Ryan Mills and Darren O'Shea and Charlie Mulcrone, all these people, because we wanted to be successful. We either were at the club where we were frustrated, we didn't have enough game time, so we all wanted to prove a point.
Mm.
And then it was always going to be a plan, an opportunity to maybe come up in our first year, but definitely come up in our second year.
Yeah.
And then be a stable club within whatever lock position, and then ultimately kick on. Because if we're brutally honest with ourselves, a place like Warriors, you have to start kicking on to then ultimately win silverware.
Mm.
because that's why we're all here. And I'm not a person that's preaching winning is everything, but you have to strive to be the ultimate best.
I think the difficulty comes, GJ, when you look at changes of leadership then, right? Through our period at Worcester, and you've come and you've been pitched this amazing dreams, just like I was. I think my conversation with Dean was slightly different because I was 22 or something, and he basically came and said, "This is what we're doing. Do you want to be part?" And I was like, yeah, sweet, sweet, sweet.
And then, I
don't think it was the same to-ing and fro-ing and courting that you might have had, but that is the nature of what you'd achieved, and I'd achieved very little silverware wise or really had 20 caps for Ulster. But so the change in leadership's the really difficult point, isn't it? Because it creates like mass amounts of inconsistencies, and then the next coach has his idea of what's right, and then the next coach has his idea of what's right. And do you think that has been where the Warriors have always struggled to kind of really take those steps forward, because we've had lack of inconsistencies in leadership at the top of the tree?
Yes, and we also, it was not this season, but previous seasons, the pressure is extremely high because of relegation. Before even a minute of rugby bins played at the start of the season, Worcester's name is always thrown in the relegation cap.
Yeah.
But that is a reality. Like that, it angers me when I hear that, but that is reality. I've got to accept it because we've simply not been good enough. Now you add the pressure of a relegation, which is financially big for the club. You add hidden agendas, because people, sadly, we're in a game where it's mostly men, testosterone driven, and we got egos. Mm-hmm. So we consciously or unconsciously, we've got an agenda sometimes. And my frustration with rugby is that sometimes that gets the better of a rugby club. No person is bigger than any rugby club, whether that's me, you, or anybody who's been a Warriors. We are not bigger than the rugby club. The club should always be the biggest thing and should always be there for years to come. But I've always felt that there were either people that did not see it that way. They either saw it as a stepping stone onto something greater, which they would then push people or careers or whatever in a direction because they did not care as much as other people would have. And I fundamentally feel that's where Worcester's been lacking a bit of consistency at the very top level, because ultimately that determines in which direction the ship's going.
Yeah.
Me and you as a rugby player can't steer the ship. We can make sure the ship's running. We can make sure it's clean and it's efficient. But if the ship's not running in the right direction, which we can't determine, it's tough. It's tough to be successful. And that's where I'm excited about the next 3 years. A young guy like Jonathan Thomas has got time on his side. He's got a young squad, which is sometimes easier because these young players haven't got the
baggage.
Haven't got the baggage, or they haven't got the experience me and you have. So if you tell me to run through a wall now, I'll tell you no, it's going to hurt, and I think there's a door somewhere. Or, but if you tell me at 21 years old, I'm like, okay, coach, how many times? Yes, I'll do it. I'll jump over it. I'll run through it. So maybe it's an easier time. But yeah, it's definitely something Worcester's been lacking.
I just think you mentioned it with the ship direction. You know, it's never. No one really knows whether the direction you're heading is right until quite far into the journey, but when the journey's changing direction and destination, that can be really challenging as a player. I think we've seen and been through our fair share of coaches, directors of rugby's, and it just provides this awful inconsistency on many, 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 many platforms. And I think,
if you look at the most successful teams in any high-performance environments, whether it's rugby or cricket, consistency is one of the most important things.
Yeah.
Consistency in management, consistency in selection.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most important things, because people don't like uncertainty.
Mm.
I might perform well if I'm uncertain about selection for a couple of weeks, but if it is constantly uncertain whether I'm playing or not playing, it's not the best of me because it now becomes an emotional toll I'm carrying with me, which you shouldn't be carrying.
Yeah.
Our game is very simple. And it's probably one of the best games ever because our game's simple. It's a physical game. It's a simple game. We can make it as complicated as we want, or we can make it as simple as we want. But if I'm carrying baggage that is not needed, I will never perform at my highest level. And that's what we need people to do. If you're a coach in today's world, when you get to the level we're playing at, I shouldn't be telling you how to catch or to pass or to tackle. Or there's technical stuff in lineout mauling, lineouts and scrums, which are coaches you learn. But ultimately, my job is to get the very best out of you. Because I can walk a very long mile with someone that's not the best player or hasn't got the most ability, as long as they're a good person. Mm-hmm. And then my job's easy, because then I just make sure I get the best out of you.
Yeah.
And how do I get the best out of you if I know you're a good person? Easy, because I'll love to spend time with you. Mm-hmm. It won't be a difficult thing for me to go and have a coffee with you or invite you over for dinner or whatever it may be, because I like you. Mm-hmm. We might not be best friends, but if you're a good human being, I'll spend time with you.
Yeah.
And then I get to know you. Then I push your button. So whether it's Leicester Tigers away and I really need something from you, 5 meter scrum on our own five, I know what to say.
Yeah.
Because I know exactly what's going to make you go.
Yeah.
In a good way or in a bad way. Because sometimes you can push it too far.
Yeah. I just think, it's been an amazing journey. And I think that your perspective through your rugby time at Worcester in particular has been one thing that I've been kind of keen to touch on, because you've all, you know, you had this huge leadership opportunity, the champ year, we come up. And then there's obviously the period of time that you spend out with your concussion, which is presents its own challenge personally for you, but professionally too. I think the first game of the Prem season, 2016-17, you suffered what would probably be described as a fairly innocuous bang to the head.
Just a bit of whiplash. I ran a short line, micro, it's fair to him, just knocks me off the ball, just stops me, nothing more than that.
Yeah.
And I just had this throbbing headache, and I was like, go down on my knee, and I'm like, oh, I can't go down, South African on South African, I won't give him it.
Yeah.
I won't give him it, and then might have walked off then or the next phase, but it wasn't much much longer after that where I just felt, something's wrong. Did the normal protocol, HIA, Karen, lovely doctor. She said to me, well done, you've passed everything. And I said to her, I don't think I'm fine. I don't think I should go back on. And she's like, are you sure? I was like, yeah, something's not right. And then that was it.
So when you were describing the feeling of something not being right, was it still just the throbbing in your head? Was it the dizziness that I know you ended up having towards the mid, the end part of the symptoms?
It was a throbbing headache. It's probably the only thing I remember.
Yeah.
Still stayed over in London that night, went to friends of ours, had a lovely dinner, had a glass of wine, slept the night, slept fine, woke up the next morning, but I almost felt hungover. And I was like, this can't be. I know I'm getting older, but I'm not here having a hangover from a glass of wine.
No.
Drove home, and I was like, had paracetamol, ibuprofen, didn't really go away. Turned up the next Monday, turned up to work, and I remember we sat at a meeting. We sat in the review, and the lights, it feels like it's stinging me through the eyes. Oof. And as a rugby player, I've always, we've got the ability to deal with pain, I believe.
Yeah, 100%.
Because if we don't have this sick way of dealing with pain, we won't be professional rugby players, because you're constantly in pain. I was like, this can't be. I can deal with a bad back or tight hamstrings or whatever it might be, but this is just too much. Walked out of the meeting early. And then the whole process started. Then it started just to have some time off. I remember I had 4 days off, went away with very good friends of mine. If I spent time away from the club and I didn't think about it, I felt fine. As soon as I got back into the club, as soon as I did any form of training, it just went straight back on. I don't normally go and do the grocery shopping, but as soon as I walked down the aisle, I was like it feels like somebody's got a laser in my eye or something the whole time. I feel like I want to close my eyes the whole time. And then all the scans started, all the CT scans, and then you drive down to London. You know the process. You've been through it. You drive down to London, you see the specialist. They're quite unsure. They always sit on the fence. No one can tell you whether it's right or wrong.
No one wants to have an opinion on it, do they? Because they just don't know, really.
Well, what does a rugby player want to know?
He wants to know whether he can play or not.
And he wants to know, are you going to make it worse or not? If you're going to make it worse, you go, all right, I need some time off.
Yeah.
It's like an AC joint. We've had both of that. You can't hurt it any further. It's always going to be painful. Yeah. Just crack on. You go, all right, I accept it. I'll move on. It's part of what we are and what we do.
But your brain's different, isn't it?
Yes. And it became meeting up, meeting down, meeting up. And I don't know how many weeks I was out for now. And then Nick Johnson suggested have some time away from the club. I had some more time away from the club. Again, it was okay at home. I couldn't. Luckily, I'm not a gamer. I don't spend a lot of time on any laptops.
Shocking gamer.
Yeah, I haven't got any thumbs to do it. So yeah, I could watch a TV program and then I'd be like, oh, this is not good. I'll go and walk the dogs, feel better. Like that type of thing. Got back again, nothing improved. And then Buck Gladly, Julie Ayton, who's now used to be with us, she was exceptional. We just sat down one day. I think she gave me a book about concussion, which I read halfway through, and I was like, Julie, this is the biggest load of shit. Like, this is not for me. Thank you, but no thank you. But all that book got me to do was to write down exactly my routine. How much do I eat and drink, coffee-wise? What time do I wake up? Yeah. What's my hydration level? So we can cover all those bases to make sure that I'm not doing anything I shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
But then I'll never, ever forget. It was 11 November. We got down to London. This must have been now the 10th trip down to London. Mm. And Mike Lancaster, I said to him, let's have a bit of fun. Let's dress up really smartly. Go and see the specialist, whatever the specialist is going to say. And then we go out for a nice coffee or a nice lunch and we come back. Another trip to London. Fair play to Mike. Mike's like, brilliant idea. Let's do it. So both of us dress up smartly, chino shirt, jacket, tie. So you got to think, there's two rugby players or people from rugby environment. Sat down with this neurosurgeon. And there's a little bit of an uncomfortable feeling. Now, I've been there the week before. I went for a load of tests and stuff. And one of the tests they did is they pour ice cold water in your eardrum, down your ear, and then you just turn your head, it all runs out, and then you should feel dizzy. I didn't feel dizzy whatsoever. Hot water, same thing. Didn't feel dizzy. And the girl who did all the testing said, oh, that's not normal. But what is normal? We don't know what's normal. I don't play a normal game. Like, for me and you, things are normal, but for other people in the public, it would be abnormal. It'd be mental. And then we also had this test where I sat strapped into you imagine a racing seat. You've done it. And then the screen, it's like you're looking out a train window and it's just like, and I could not, it made me feel so nauseous and I felt terrible. Mm. Didn't think too much of it because I think, what person could do this? Mm. Nobody should enjoy doing this. So we sat there and I'm supposed to get my results back from all these tests I did the week before. And she looked at me, she looked at the paper, looked at me, looked at Mike, looked down to the paper, and she put the paper, she tapped him on the table, and she sat him down and said, if you were my son, I would have told you to never play rugby again. I don't think you should play rugby. And my face dropped, everything dropped. And whatever she said after that, I could not tell you. I had no idea. Walked out the meeting, I'm as white as a glass of milk. And Mike's like, Mike's like, are you all right? I'm like, Mike, I don't know. He's like, come on, let's go and have a coffee. Let's talk about this. I was like, Mike, no, sorry. I'll make my own way home. He's like, what do you mean? I was like, don't worry. I need to spend some time on my own. Whatever age I'm now, who would have thought that's how it's going to finish? This old lady telling me I shouldn't be playing rugby. What does she know? I'm going to prove her wrong. And then I go, oh, but hold on. This is not a broken leg. There's no ligaments. Like, this is my brain. I want to be able to play with my kids one day. I want to have a healthy lifestyle. I want to do triathlons, those type of things. Like, I can't risk this. I then told Mike to get on the car on his own. He reluctantly went, but it got to a stage where I said to Mike, you've got to leave me alone here now. I need some time on my own. I walked around London on my own, eventually got a train back. Probably spent 2 hours on the phone to my parents back home, and my dad just kept on. So my dad's a doctor as well, and he just kept on saying, just relax. Like, it's not that important. And I'm like, what do you mean it's not important? It's my career. It's everything. It's why I'm in England for. Like, I've said to Manan to come over, and we're going to do this thing now properly. And, like, don't tell me to relax. Yeah. And the frustrating thing, what is it? You just relax more and more and more. And, like, put the phone down, phone him again, and it was like a roller coaster of emotions that weekend because it happened on, it might have been a Thursday or Friday. And it was just like, I can't believe this is it. Like, this is ridiculous. Turned up to the club on the Monday and Julie Ayton was there and she said to me, don't worry, GJ. Like, what does she know? And I was like, here we go. This is somebody Julie, I can work with.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, me, Julie, me and you, we're going to show her. So, to cut a long story short, the diagnosis was that I injured my ear canal, which you can do through trauma or high impact. So they normally see in people who have a car crash or something like that. So I went to go see a vestibular physio who gave me a load of exercises to do, which he said it would improve it. We didn't improve it to an extent where I could play again, probably not. But there are players in the NFL who have returned after a period of 3 years. Again, that's all I needed. It could improve, and people have done it in 3 years. So what does GJ go? I'll show you. I'll do it in 12 months because I want to prove you wrong. And then the whole journey started. It was tough, ultimately very enjoyable. I learned a lot about myself. I knew how resilient I was. I managed to get my body in a shape I've not been before because I had no contact for 12 months. I had the ability to start from a crawl to a run to then to a sprint. Yeah. I've never been that strong in a gym ever. Like, I was lucky enough to work with Eamon, who both of us, we respect him hugely.
Yeah.
Julie Ayton again pushed me to another level. So that 12 months ended up being extremely enjoyable. It was not so enjoyable from a rugby point of view because I wasn't that close to the team where I could say, like, have an impact. Mm. We also went through the transition of Carl Hogg and Gary Gold. Omar joined the club. The only bit I found difficult in that period was I had no cast. I had no crutches. I had new coaches turn up. And the first instinct is, what do they think of me?
Yeah,
I'm here on the gravy train. I'm getting a paycheck and I'm loving my life.
Yeah.
That's the only bits that was tough. But ultimately, got told, as bizarre rugby is, got told, oh, you got to prove your full fitness, otherwise the club's going to cut your contract. And I said to them, what does full fitness mean? What do I have to prove? Oh, you've just got to be able to hit a tackle bag and a tackle shield a few times, and you've got to do it on the 15th of June. I left that meeting laughing. I'm thinking, idiots. Even if I'm not right,
I'll hit a tackle back
a couple of times. I've had pain in my life, and I'll never forget. I rocked up to the club, boots on, gum shield. Here we go. Who rocks up? Eamon. Yeah. Eamon's carrying a tackle shield and a tackle bag, and he puts me through a test in the barn, like up downs. It was quite a tough session, to be fair, but that's all I had to do. Tackled him once, twice, and I was like, oh, I don't feel anything. I feel brilliant. Like We've built up a lot. My neck strength is better than it's ever been because that was one of Julie's big things, was to make sure your neck can withhold any contact.
Yeah.
I'm strong. I'm fit. I'm feeling great. We got through that. Got home. Like, had a lovely meal that night. Me and Mananta. I was like, yeah, I think I feel brilliant. Like, this is, yeah, we're back. Here we go. Preseason started. And then we did you remember the DEFCON sessions we did with Omar.
Yeah.
And, who I get paired up with? Who? Will Spencer.
Big mutant.
Will Spencer only goes 100%.
Yeah.
And all we got to do is we're tackling the living daylight out of each other, rep after rep after rep after rep. And by like half, it's quite a tough session. You're up, you're down. It's made to break you. And I'm like, Omar's not going to break me. I'll tell you, I'm going to show him he's not going to break me. But Will Spencer is definitely breaking me. Like,
breaking a few people.
The cracks are starting to show. I got through my first DEFCON session on the Friday.
You know.
And I was like, yeah, I'm fine.
Yeah.
I did the second one and I felt horrendous. Like, I felt it. Same story back. Like, headache on the Friday night. Very hot day. Pale skin, that might be a reason, dehydrated. So I don't think too much about it. Got to the Monday, don't feel great again. I'm like, oh, I've got to confess. Like, this is not, I'm not right. And I'll never forget, Mananta said to me that evening, he's like, what's wrong with you? Like, everybody gets a headache. Just get on with it. And I sat there, like, feeling sorry for myself. Like, what do you know? Like, you've never been through this. Woke up the next morning, felt brilliant. I was fine, cracked on. And, like, to me, that was the thing. Like, Mananta telling me to just get on with it, because I think it's quite a South African thing to do. Like, if young kids fall, get up, go on. Come on, just don't make a fuss of it. I think that was a big thing. And then I managed to get through that preseason and I was flying. I played all the preseason warm-up games. I felt brilliant. I felt fit. I listened to a podcast earlier the week before our first Prem game, which was Newcastle away. I think it was Benny Teo's first game, and it was an interview with Travis Pastrana, the motorbike daredevil, And they go through all his injuries and like how many cracked ribs, wrists, this. And he said a thing in the episode where he said, like, I know I'm going to get injured again. Mm. I know it's a fact. It's going to happen again, but it's not today. Like, and that little sentence just stuck by me. Like, every Saturday before a game, you'd get nervous. And I'm not someone who used to get nervous. I'd be like, oh, here we go again. And then I'd remind myself, like, I'll get injured again, definitely. But today is not the day. And then, yes, I was lucky enough to end up playing. I think I played maybe 13 games on the bounce, back-to-back, 80 minutes, all 13 weeks after each other. And then I actually played my 50th game against Connacht with Donico Callan. Yeah. And then I got my first head knock again that day. But I was never concerned about it. I felt fine afterwards. I had an extra week off, which I had to because of my history. But then came back, and it's probably one of my best seasons I played for Worcester Warriors. That season I came back.
Yeah, I remember it vividly. I was out injured, but I watched all the games, and the pride of you getting back playing after it was just huge. And I think when you talk about all these adversities, all these challenges that you faced, that was a huge challenge both physically, emotionally, professionally. You also harnessed your ability to make a success of yourself away from rugby too, which probably gave you a sense of, I don't know, not just a welcome distraction at times, but your business child was born. So VVS, Van Velden Smith, was born during that period. I suppose some context on how the company came together, how your partner Graham Smith is involved and how you met him, and what the business side of your life allowed you to get back from whenever you were missing periods at the club. Because I think one of the things we've talked about in the podcast hugely is that good rugby players are balanced people.
Yeah, it's the most important thing.
So, I mean, like you that probably gave you an opportunity, an outlet that you didn't have from your rugby at the time, because you were, as you said, really slowly building up your progress.
So, very interesting story again. So, I was at Northampton. I played against Saracens first game back. I got banned 5 weeks into my second game at Saints for a dangerous tackle against Will Chudley, who's now joining us in the summer.
Yeah.
I got banned 5 weeks and then came back, played my first game for Saints. It was against Saracens, and I had a really good game, man of the match. Got a message on either an email or a message on Twitter saying, well done on today's performance. We'd love to meet you, the Smiths. And I, lovely, like, I don't know who the Smiths are, but I'll reply to them. I said, oh, thank you very much. I appreciate the message. Let me know. Love to catch up. Straight away, message back, ping. How does the Halston's pub sound on Wednesday night? I said, never. I've done one fitness session in a village called Halston. I remember there was a lovely looking pub. Never been there. Good opportunity for me to go. I'm on my own in England. Why not? Turned up to the Halston. I met Graham Smith and his daughter, Rachel. We had an unbelievable evening. We just like connected straight away. Mm. They became really good family for me and a support structure. I spent my first three Christmases at their house.
Good people.
Very good people. And when I had to take time off from the club, I went away with Graham and his son, Matt. And Graham's a businessman. He's constantly pushing me. And he said to me, GJ, what are you going to do post-rugby? Never said it in a way of you are injured now with concussion, you need to think about a second career. Mm. He just wanted me to do something. He's a guy that's got a lot of energy for business. He's got a lot of energy for new and exciting things in life, and he never sits still. So the idea came, just mentioned it to him, like me moving over from South Africa. I had tracksuit bottoms I wore. I had a t-shirt and a really good khaki jacket, which is one I use on a hunting trip. So that was my winter gear. James Wilson took me out shopping in Milton Keynes, and he bought me maybe two pairs of jeans and five t-shirts and a pair of boots.
Thank you, James Wilson, for doing that.
And he said to me, GJ, from now on, this is what you wear on a night out. When we go for coffee, make an effort. I said, brilliant. So I was known as jeans, t-shirt, boots. Loved a pair of boots. Always wanted to own a pair of R.M. Williams boots, but they're always too expensive. So I spoiled myself one Christmas. I said, this is the GJ's buying GJ R.M. Williams boots. Mm. So I was in my boots and my jeans and my t-shirt. That was me always, still is today. And then we had a dinner one night, and I said to him, how cool would it be if you made your own boots? Mm. Like, how cool would it be to have your own brand, and it's just, it's boots. It's The idea of you only need one pair of shoes because we live in a life where we've got too much. We either don't use it or we throw it away or have one pair of boots that are going to last you a lifetime. So this ultimately should be an investment. So you turn 21, your dad's bought you a pair of nice Chelsea boots because that's all you need. Mm. You can dress them up, you can dress them down. And I remember I thought when I was chatting, I thought he was going to, don't be silly. And he just looked at me and he's like, brilliant. Why don't we do it? And I was like, what? He's like, brilliant, let's do it. So then obviously I had a lot of time on my hands. I realized Spain is well known for making boots. Italy is well known. But Spain, the opportunity Spain gave was one out of every four people is unemployed in rural Spain. Most of the shoes are being made in rural Spain. Mm. So I then thought about along the ways, like, how do you make a difference where it's not going to solve the problem, but you might help someone out? So I just decided I want to work with family-oriented companies. I want to work with companies that are in a rural area, and I will find a company that will private label my own designs. Mm-hmm. I'm not a designer from any sorts, but I got most of the women involved at the rugby club for them on a Pinterest board for them just to tag their favorite boots. I knew what I liked. So I then looked at all these things on a table. I know what I like. I know what girls wear. So I made this whole catalog together, and then that's where it started. Four or five trips over to Spain, maybe one or two times had a translator, one or two times tried myself, rocked up to companies, knocked on the door, and then ultimately found a company to work with.
I think the progression and the journey is just fascinating. And I think the position that you're in now, where it's a well-established, you know, boot, and you've got a great catalogue of quality boots that, like, genuinely I've bought myself. I mean, I think he charged me 500% of what they actually should have been on for, but I pay it for you. I think do you feel like – you must feel really proud when you see boys rocking about them in town and stuff. Like, I know I do wear them, and I'll always check to see if you notice if I'm wearing them. And you always notice. I think the first thing you look at is people's shoes. So when you tie in the pride of that, what's the projection? What's the plan for the brand?
So like you say, I always look where people have got on their feet. For some reason, it's become a thing. And what was it, maybe 3 weeks ago, I walked past someone I've never met, don't know, and they were wearing a pair of my boots.
That's cool.
And that was like a very proud moment. Had an enormous grin on my face. And Mananta's like, what's wrong with you? I was like,
VVS.
Look, what you're wearing. And I was like, yeah, that's the Protea. That's the Protea is named after a flower in South Africa, which was also Mananta's wedding bouquet. So it's like, look, she's wearing it. So those moments, I love that. They make me extremely proud. But ultimately, for me, VVS is passion. It's in a market that's very competitive. It's in a market that people have millions of pounds of budgets for marketing, for brand awareness, those type of things, which I obviously don't have. So for me, it's an absolute passion. It's going to take a lot of time to grow. It's going to take a lot of hard work and a lot of luck for it to grow where I want it to be. But my whole aim with VVS is to educate people that we don't need multiple pairs of shoes. You can buy quality and you can buy once for a long time. And my aim is to make a bit of a difference. I, like you know, come from South Africa. We played barefoot rugby up until the age of 13. So for me, I can ultimately sell you a pair of boots and I can give away a pair of rugby boots to that kid who's 13 years old, whose parents maybe couldn't afford them to buy a pair of boots.
Yeah.
So I'd like to connect that with a training camp. Obviously, COVID's made it impossible for us to get over there, but the aim is we get over to South Africa, we invite however many, whether it's 50 to 100 or 200 kids, we get people involved like Wynand Olivier, ex-Springboks, current Springboks, and we do a bit of a coaching clinic.
Yeah.
And these kids get a brand new pair of boots. So they don't get a hand-me-down, they get a size 7 if they're a size 7. Because you know at the rate we grow at that age, you're probably only going to wear your boots for 2 years maximum.
Easy.
So I remember my first pair of boots. I remember the day me and my dad went. We chose the boots. It's a big thing in South Africa when you and your dad's going to buy, get your first pair of boots. It's a big thing to make that step up where you've got socks that needs to go up right underneath your ankles. And there's, unfortunately, in today's world, there's kids that either financially their parents can't afford it or there's not a father figure who takes them. And I don't want kids to miss out because we're extremely lucky to play the game we have or the game we do. we're extremely fortunate to get to the level we were. And it'd be devastating to know that there's kids who will not even have the opportunity just because of a financial reason or a demographical reason.
Yeah.
So hopefully VVS can make a difference in someone's life like that. Yes, I want to be a sustainable company. Yes, I want to be a profitable company, because I firmly believe that profits keep you channeled in the right direction. It keeps you concentrated because you need to make a success of things. The way I've treated my rugby career is always, I want to be the best. I might not be the best in a thing, but all around I am striving to be the utmost best. And that's the same I wish for VVS. I want to produce a shoe that is the very best.
Yeah.
I want you to put that boot on and to go, I could spend the day walking with my missus and shopping. I could go on a night out and I'd feel comfortable. I'm not precious about it. I can use them. Like, that's when I want to give you the all-round shoe that you're going to go, yeah, sorted. Weekend away, pair of jeans, I'm sorted.
Oh, man, I love it. I think we gave away a pair of free boots last season, and I know the fella, Ryan Martin, who ended up actually winning them, and he was delighted with them, and it was really, really appreciated. So thank you for your support through that channel, GJ. I think the boots are only going to take steps forward. They're only going to continue to progress with the passion and the drive that you have for that kind of business interest. Very business savvy, I would say. So in a roundup, right, let's look to round this up. So you went on to become the 25th centurion in Worcester history. Very, very proud. I'm sure you were delighted to notch the achievement. What does the future hold for GJ Van Velde?
Yeah, so my time, 7 seasons have come to an end at Warriors, a time I've really enjoyed. Like, it's sometimes difficult to show your appreciation. Well, I find it difficult to show my appreciation to supporters or close friends like Kay and Barry, because I'm not good with that side of showing appreciation, but I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I've thoroughly enjoyed playing with people I like to spend time with. Extremely proud to have played my 100th game. It's something I never felt rugby should be about one person. The club should always be bigger, like I've said, but that's an achievement. I was surprised that I managed to get it. I missed out at 50 with I missed out on my 50th with Northampton.
2 games, yeah.
So yeah, it's a proud moment. Would I have wanted to win more games as a Warrior player and play less games? Definitely. Would I swap for more silverware? Definitely, because I think that's more important to the club, because it's never about me. But the fact that I've managed to do it, the fact that I've stayed fit for however many games, I've started a large majority of those games. I played considerable amounts of minutes in most of those games. So those parts I really enjoyed.
And I think if you were to have the opportunity just to, you know, obviously in the knowledge that you're not going to be a Worcester player next year, if you had the opportunity just to say a few words to the fans, what would your message be?
I think it's that saying where you don't know how much you appreciate something until it's gone. Like, when this whole pandemic hit and we were there, the thought of playing again without any crowds, I was like, yeah, it's not going to make a huge difference. Like, I played with no crowds as an under-19-year-old for the Bulls, so I know what it feels like. But the last 2 weeks where we've actually had a handful of people back, you realize the big difference it makes.
I agree.
Rugby is an extremely special sport. I don't think rugby is in a good place currently. I think it's in a unstable place, just with the whole model, the way rugby is being run in this country, the financial impacts it has, the amount of players that are going to be without any contracts, and numerous players are good enough to continue playing, but we're just the demographics changed. The ballpark is a different game now. So we miss out. A lot of players are going to miss out on finishing their careers the way they should, which is sad. But then again, it's life. But yeah, the people at Worcester have been exceptional to me and Mananta. We've enjoyed our time here. And let's be honest, if you're a Warriors fan, you're an absolute diehard fan, because most people follow success. And this club have not had success, and it will have success in the new future. So I hope they'll get rewarded for their time, their passion. And I hope that a club like yours, or players like yourself, and a club like Worcester can inspire the next generation, because our game is not sustainable without young kids playing it. and there's enough articles going around the environment where rugby's not good or the risk involved or the concussion, but it's an unbelievable game. It's a humbling game. It teaches you a lot of life lessons. Respect is one of the huge parts of our game. And I think it plays a very important role in kids' lives, and it should do, and it should continue for a long time. So yeah, I'm extremely fortunate to sit here today and to achieve what I have. But the chapter's not done. Whatever is next is going to be amazing for me, because I know I'm in control for the first time in a long time. It's important for me to get home. It's important to go and see my family again. We haven't seen each other for 18 months.
So
I'm going to take 6 months off where I'm going to prioritize a few things in my life, which I think is important.
Definitely.
I think it's important for me to take a step back and to assess the whole idea, the environment. Of course, I want to play for as long as I can, but I also want to achieve other things like finishing an Ironman one day, and you need recent good health to do that. So there's a few things. It's exciting. It's daunting in a way, but it's exciting, and I'm looking forward to it.
I have no doubt in my mind, whatever direction it goes, you'll be a huge success. If you need someone to be the bad man to come tell you you can't do it, I'm more than happy to do it.
The thing is, I won't believe you because we're so similar.
We're too similar. You know, I'll be saying it with a grin on my face. But GJ, I want to say a huge thank you for your time. I think a good opportunity for you to just basically share so many of amazing stories that the people out sometimes, they're just so, we do such a poor job of expressing our stories as rugby players. You know, it's all very social media based, and it's what you think you should post and what you think you should say. And I think what this provides is a great opportunity. The feedback that we've had from people like Francois, that you get and real insight into the people themselves. And being one of your good mates, I know that you're a top quality person, and I'm glad that people are going to get the opportunity to see that. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. I think, just to say on that, I think it's important. I think this game needs more of that. I think we need to allow people to be themselves. But sadly, society have gone away where we judge very easily. Everybody's got the ability to have an opinion. So it's difficult for players like yourself. Like, we know Ollie Lawrence very well. He's an exceptional talent, but will he be allowed to be himself?
Yeah.
Sometimes he might be strong enough, and he will be. Other times you think the poor kid's going to take it from all directions. So our game definitely needs that. Our game needs to allow people to be themselves, to express themselves. And hopefully one day we'll see a Wind Your Neck In production where it's behind the scenes we give people a better insight into what goes in a rugby club and the sacrifices players make and the coaches. And because sometimes it's quite serious and we take ourselves too serious, and there's other times where we're too laid back. But I think anything you watch, the Last Dance, the Drive to Survive, the NFL stuff on Prime, we all love them. Everybody loves them who's involved in sport, because we get a different insight. And I think there's probably people are looking at this, but companies, I think it's an opportunity to give people a platform where they can express themselves and the game can actually grow, because it's not growing.
Yeah. Stop giving them all our plans, would you? Stop giving away our master plan for the future. But no, I appreciate your time, GJ. It's been great to have a chat, and we're just wishing you all the best for the future, you and Mananta, and look after yourself, and thank you.
No, thank you very much.